morning, everybody. This is WTBR's Morning Drive. My name is Bill Sturgeon. I'm going to be with you for about 55 minutes today. Buckle your seatbelts and open up your minds. This is the future. And this gentleman that you see sitting there, Jonathan Costa, he made a presentation to the Pittsfield School Committee, worked with the management team of the Pittsfield School System, Mr. Curtis, and all the other players. And they came up with a report about what AI, artificial intelligence, how that will impact education. And I had to get him, and he's been gracious enough. He's a busy dude. He's been gracious enough to come on this program. I have gone through this thing page by, as you can tell, I highlight everything. I thank Sister Barbara Fye for that. She was a nut. Always underline, have an underliner or underline with a pen. But the Jonathan, this is the future. I mean, people, you can resist it, but you're only digging yourself a deeper hole.
Yeah, I just, well, thank you so much for having me, by the way. I just finished writing an article, actually, for an educational journal called Ed Elements on the topic of Chesterton's Fence, which is a early 20th century book written by G.K. Chesterton, in which he creates a framework to say, if you come across a fence in the middle of the road, you know, don't take it down until you understand its purpose. And the article I wrote is about educators who don't, his admonition is, consider it carefully before you take it down. And right, what some people have, are thinking is not consider it carefully before you take it down, but don't take it down for any reason whatsoever. It's almost the opposite of what Chesterton is arguing for, sort of blind adherence. And you really need to engage with this topic carefully, because blind adherence to what got us here has very little to do with what is coming. And to me, that is the biggest challenge for people in public education, is how to reimagine the future of education without being tied to what the past of public education was.
Yeah, and just my background was civil service. Mm-hmm. Let's say it at that. And I've been, towards the end of my career, sent all over the world. But in civil service in this country, in the United States, and you've probably heard this in various ways in education. Well, we got to change. We've always done it that way. And to me, when I'm watching yours, I'm thinking, oh, my God, some of these people will take a shovel and dig that hole deeper and deeper. You got to learn phonics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
There's a, you know, if we think about writing, for example, I think what we need to be able to do is separate the rote learning that precedes writing from writing itself. So my high school AP language teacher, this is the 1970s, so it goes back a ways. One of his favorite phrases is, writing is thinking. And I completely agree with him. Right. Writing is thinking. But memorizing rules of grammar is a much lower cognitive lift than constructing an argument. So if I have tools available to me that allow me to save hours and hours, years and years of memorization to get right to the point, construct the argument, bring in the evidence, do what you need to do to make your point, then what am I going to do with all the hours I saved getting there?
Right.
And that changes the way we think about teaching and learning and goals for learning for kids. Because in the end, what is defined as an educated person in an age of AI is going to be fundamentally different from the way we defined it in an analog era. And right now, a lot of what we say kids must have, they don't need. And there's a faster way to get there. And what are you going to do with the time you save, with the acceleration? And if you, even if, and I don't believe you could do this, but even if you could prove to me that memorization, straight memorization, is the best way to train a mind to think, you are not going to be able to sell it to a generation of kids who understand what these tools can do and how fast that they can use them to get what they need. So in my organization, we talk to school districts about vulnerable and durable in the face of AI. So goals for learning, teaching methods, and assessment methods that are vulnerable to AI mean that if I have my phone with me and you've given me a test and I can use that phone to answer all the questions on your test, then that whole framework is vulnerable to being undermined by AI. Whereas if it's durable, the phone's not going to help me. You're going to ask me about what I think, how I defend it, what's my opinion, and what do I use to support it. And I have to be able to converse with you and tell you and do it in a way that demonstrates I am doing the thinking. I'm doing the cognitive work of thinking without the baggage of some of the rote background that led to it. So it's a challenge because we haven't used that lens as a filter before today.
And it's I think one of the things, so before I forget, to show, illustrate your point, I was in a business math course in the 1970s when I came back from Vietnam. And one of the fellas said, or one of the other students said, is it okay if we use a calculator? And I thought the guy was going to blow a fuse. Why would you want to use a calculator? It's quicker, it's easier, it doesn't make mistakes. You know, if I put in the right thing, I'm going to get the right answer. And it was strictly forbidden.
Yeah.
And so it kind of dovetails in with your thing about you're going to have to relinquish some of these well-entrenched learning theories.
Sure. And this is not new, right? So before the calculator, there was a slide rule.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I can take my phone, take a picture of a problem, and have AI do chain of thought reasoning, and not only solve the problem for me, but explain to me how they solve the problem. You know, it's really hard to understate what the change is and how close it is to actually coming.
And I learned a long time ago in a whole different series of scenarios, you can let fear overcome you or you can overcome fear. Mm. And I think there are so many people that are afraid of it rather than trying to understand it. As I said to one of my friends, this artificial intelligence isn't new. And he goes, yes, it is. I said, no, I know a lot of people walking around that have artificial intelligence. Just talk to them.
You know? Well, so it's interesting because if you look at the history of it, for at least 10 years, it was under development and behind the scenes. So when I talk to audiences, I will often say, you know, how many of you have interacted with AI in a way that was under your control? Because almost everyone has interacted with it in a way that they didn't even know to the introduction, the public-facing ChatGPT in November of 2022. So it has been underway for a long time. It's just the explosion on the surface of consumable public-facing tools where now the genie is out of the bottle and we're off to the races.
Jonathan, one of the other things that I interviewed Joe the other day. He's going to play on Monday. You're going to play on Tuesday. So I will email you his link. But one of the other questions that how many of the schools of education are embracing this new way? Because if they're still teaching phonics, you know, when the teacher graduates and they go to a school that's going to be progressive with AI, they're going to be out of luck. Yeah. Or certainly have learning curves.
Sure. And, you know, to be clear, before people panic, I mean, if you want to teach traditional reading, phonics still matters, right? And it depends on the way you learn. Some kids don't need as much of it as others. And just like everything else, the best strategy is a blend based on what the individual student needs. But putting that aside, you know, schools of education at higher ed level are not consistent in their approach. There are some who are attempting to understand it and dig into it, and there are others that are resisting it and pushing back. So it is something that the market, I think, eventually will help decide. Because if you are a teacher or you want to become an educator and you are going through a program that doesn't give you an opportunity to master or learn these tools, I think your marketability on the outside once you're done is going to be dramatically limited. So that's an issue. And I wanted to go back to something else you said too. I also don't want to seem to your audience that I believe that AI is a panacea and that there aren't any potential downsides. There are a lot of potential downsides.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but the only mistake we can make is to pretend like it doesn't exist or wall everybody off from it and hope it will go away, because there are no way those two things are happening. No. So it requires us to be thoughtful, to be planful, and to stay up with it, because very few things have come out of the box and developed as rapidly as this technology. Right. So you can come up with a policy for what it does today, and in 8 weeks you're going to have to revisit it, because, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it can't do that until it can.
Right. For people just tuning in, this is a morning show, so it's a drive show. People are in and out and putting the kids on the bus.
Sure.
This gentleman, his name is Jonathan Costa. He presented and he's with Ed Advance. I can't read the first thing.
And Ed Advance, Advance.
Yeah, Ed Advance. And he came up and worked with our school department, the leaders of the school department, teachers, and they are approaching artificial intelligence, in my opinion, in the best way we can. Learn as much about it as you can, and then how do you implement it in the classroom? And he has been gracious enough to come on this program. So all of you, there's a presentation, and I'll put the link up on my Facebook. If you want to watch his presentation, I promise you, you'll watch it more than once, because my little old 78-year-old brain didn't grab it all. But it's amazing what the future will bring for our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I mean, things that we thought were so important that we had to memorize, it'll just be a press a button. And I give us more time for creativity.
One of the ways we describe that is, you know, for most of formal education, we design curriculum with a just-in-case mindset. So I'm going to teach you this, and you're going to learn it just in case. At some point in your life, somebody asks you this question, you need to know the answer. And we are unequivocally already and certainly going to be living in a just-in-time world. So what is it that you need at the moment you need it? and how do you integrate it with your own uniquely human intelligence to add value to what is happening in that moment? Because that is going to be the future of economic opportunity for the vast majority of people in the economy of our future.
And you know, one of the things that grabbed me right off the bat is when you, this portrait of a graduate. If you came up with that, you're more brilliant than I think you are. And I think you're pretty brilliant. Because we've never, I don't think I've ever heard anybody describe that. What are we looking for from someone who graduates?
Sure.
And so, yep. Explain, please.
So the portrait of the graduate, the vision of the graduate is really an evolution of an effort that started about 25 years ago. So the organization that accredits public high schools in New England is called the NEASC, the New England Association of Schools and Colleges. And in the early 2000s, they came up with a framework that required districts to identify the skills that they wanted to see out of their graduates. And so at that time, it was called goals for learning, or, you know, community expectations for learning. And then about right before the pandemic, 2018, 2019, it sort of was reimagined to be either the vision of the graduate or the portrait of the graduate. So it would be narrowed down a little bit, because early on, when districts were thinking of this, they would create a laundry list of 50 skills or 40 skills that they wanted every kid to know. And it was becoming clear that there was just too much. There were too many things to sort of focus on. So this idea of a portrait of a graduate or a vision of the graduate emerged as an evolution of that, to have a smaller, more focused set of goals and skills yep. that kids would be challenged to learn before they left school. And the Pittsfield strategic, vision of the graduate actually preceded this planning effort. The Pittsfield right. engaged with a number of districts in your region under funding from the Barr Foundation to yep. help collaboratively identify these skills and dispositions. And so your portrait of the graduate preceded the strategic plan, and it holds up. Right. One of the very first things we yeah. did was let's kick yeah. the tires on this, and it works fine. The biggest difference today is that what started as sort of a philosophical, this would be great, we really need to do it, is now in the realm of, boy, if we don't do this, our kids are going to really struggle, because you could know all the content you want. But yeah. If you are not a communicator, you can't critically think, you don't possess the ability to demonstrate these uniquely human skills, the vast majority of all work that doesn't require these things is going to be done by either a robot or an AI chatbot, and you are going to be frozen out of economic opportunity.
And for the people of Pittsfield, let me, and surrounding areas, go down by the old telephone company, and that big old building that used to have people wall to wall. The Polish princess, that's my wife, worked there in college as a information operator. And now if you look in those, get out of your car and look at every floor. And you know, what will you see? Racks of various technology. Not people, racks. Yep. And I'm sure that technology, Jonathan, is probably old too, but it replaced the operator.
Sure. And I mean, I could pick up my phone right now and engage in a conversation real time with a large language model. And I can assure you that nobody in your audience would be able to tell the difference between that conversation and the conversation that you and I are having right now. That is the level of sophistication they are at already, and it's only going to get better.
Yeah. And like we said, we are saying with this, what I've got all these notes. I got to ask you some of the questions. I am prepared for this more than I prepared for my final exam in college. And you do define the first notion of the Pareto principle can be defined. You do it for us, if you don't mind.
Sure. The Pareto principle comes from Wilfred Pareto, who's an Italian economist in the early 20th century. And he sort of looked around and realized that about 80% of all the land in his native country was owned by a very small group of people. And so, with that insight, he started to look at how other systems play out. And his insight was, in just about every system, there are a few root causes that drive the vast majority of what happens in that system. So if your company has a web page, 80% of the traffic is on 20% of the pages, right? If you are looking to improve performance in an organization and you identify 30 different possible areas, there are unquestionably one or two of them that would move the needle much more than the rest of them. And so the key to organizational success is laying your shoulder to the things that will make a difference and leaving behind the things that make a small difference. And this is not a new insight, even though it's called the Pareto principle. I'm a history teacher. I can show you a quote from Thomas Jefferson, who was praising Ben Franklin because he laid his shoulder to the big problems and left the little ones behind. So this has been around for a long time, but when you talk about Portrait of a Graduate, there are 50 skills you could pick. But if you don't pick the ones that matter most and zero in on them, it won't matter what you do with the rest.
And it's amazing too, how entrenched. My wife was a teacher for 42 years, first and second grade, and how dug in some of these basic principles are, and the pushback even I'm hearing is. It's maybe because I've had to adapt and overcome that whole army thing, improvise and overcome. But they just don't see the picture yet.
Well, in defense of my teaching colleagues, on the slide you're referencing, right below the Pareto principle, there's another one that says a systems orientation.
I was going to ask you about that one too.
And that is a companion that I use these two things in my planning processes. So, Pareto principle is small set of things make a really big difference. The systems orientation, this comes from W. Edwards Deming in his work in Japan. He was sent there by Douglas MacArthur because in the post-World War II era, we destroyed, physically destroyed Japan's economy. And as they rebuilt, they created things of very low quality. So if we were having this discussion in 1960s, made in Japan was synonymous with junk. Deming was brought
I
by,
remember that era.
yes. So Deming was brought to Japan by Douglas MacArthur. He was an engineer with GE, actually in New York. And he taught them that the way work gets done is the primary driver of how well it gets done. So, if we assume that most people get up every morning wanting to do a good job, and I have no question that the vast majority of people who work in the Pittsfield Public Schools do
Oh,
that.
absolutely.
They get up in the morning and they want to do what's right for kids. Very few educators wake up in the morning thinking, how can I screw it up for kids today? They want to do a good job.
That doesn't end.
What the systems orientation tells you is it's the way the job gets done that drives that quality. If you want teachers to take a different view of curriculum, we need to show them what that looks like. We need to provide the tools for them to see what that looks like. And I've said it for years, if you put a good person in a flawed system, that flawed system will win every time. So if you are in Vietnam, you know what FUBAR means.
Oh, yeah.
And we're not going to say it because I don't want to get you in trouble with the FCC. But FUBAR was brought to be because the bureaucratic system of the Army led people to screw things up.
Yes, they
did. And if you want to avoid it, you have to change the way the system works. You don't, if you could, you changed all the officers, changed all the infantrymen, give them the same tools, give them the same training, they're going to make the same mistakes. You have to change the system. So the key is combining Pareto, pick the things that matter most, with a systems orientation. Change the way you do those few things, and that will move the needle.
And you're exactly right. And as we evolve as a society, as a humanity or whatever, change has always been part of it. But there's always the group that wants to stay where it is, you know, and I don't want to bring politics into this. But there's a transition now in government, and they're looking at government, and they're finding, wait a minute, we've been paying people that are 100 or 300 years old Social Security. Where was the catch in here? And pretty soon that won't be people. That will be AI.
Yeah. Well, I will gently push back on you. That is an unfounded talking point.
Oh, okay.
Everyone that dies in this country that goes through a funeral home, home director fills out a form, and they are in the record, but they are not receiving checks. So, but I get your point. I understand where you're coming from, and there will be automation that helps to correct some of those issues.
Yeah,
it's not. And as I said, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. There will be flaws in that, too. There are well-documented AI hallucinations, right? Large language models often get some factual things wrong, and they do so confidently. And if you don't confirm some of that information, you're likely to make a mistake right along with them. But we have to... We have to navigate those challenges because there's so much money to be made and so much invested. You know, it's like going back to the Luddites who wanted to stop the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
I don't doubt the purity of their intentions,
but
the economic weight of what was on the other side made it inevitable and made their resistance look quaint. Going back and looking at it, and I think we're in the same place right now as it relates to AI.
We're going to take a 1 minute break. Please, folks, stay tuned. I have so many more questions to ask him. And it's a learn for me. I'm just like a sponge. I'm sucking it all in because, as all of you know that watch this program on there or listens to it on the radio, they don't. Technologically, they don't let me touch a thing but three buttons in the studio. In fact, I thought the technicians there were going to start making me wear mittens. But we'll be right back. This is WTBR 89.7 FM on your radio dial. We are also broadcasting on 88.1 to Southern Berkshire. And this is fascinating stuff. And if you're a parent or a grandparent, or parent-to-be, please stay tuned. You'll learn, and then you can follow up on your own, because your kids or grandkids, as mine, will run circles around you. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms. Customized solutions available. Online at sondrini.com.
Wonder what happened to those great local PCTV channels? Did you lose them? No worries, they're still there. Go to cable channels 1301, 1302, and 1303 to watch the best local content on television. News and information, sports and entertainment, city council, school committee, July 4th parade. It's all there waiting for you. Pittsfield Community Television. For over 30 years, we are still your local television.
This summer, the City of Pittsfield will release its first cultural plan, and we want you to be a part of this exciting event. Funded by the National Endowment for the Arts, Our Town program, the plan includes contributions from cultural organizations and partners that make Pittsfield great, and with input from community members like you. Whether you're an artist, audience member, producer, or creative hobbyist, this plan is for you. So stay tuned to lovepittsfield.com this summer for more information.
People tune in to hear the latest local and national news.
That's not us.
People tune in to hear the latest music.
That's definitely not us.
People tune in to hear political pundits expound on politics.
No, 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 that's not us.
How about people tune in to hear entertaining stories, jokes, odd topics, and laughter?
Oh, yeah, that's us. That's Stuff.
Tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 to listen to the latest Stuff with Bev Prentice and Lynn Arsenault on 89.7 WTBR-FM.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org. And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, we're back. I'm here today with a wonderful guy, a visionary, an educator, and a person who's responding to my kind of silly questions sometimes. But his name is Jonathan Costa. He is came up here to Pittsfield, worked with the school system, and adapted a plan to introduce AI and what AI means in education. In this part of the program, I'm going to ask him, what is some of the things that he envisions? Well, jobs that'll poof, be gone, because AI will take the jobs over. And let's not be afraid of it. Let's learn about it. You can let fear overcome you, or you can overcome fear. Believe me, I know from experience. And I would say that this program, and this will be, if we don't pick it all up, it will be accessible on our website, WTBRPCTV, and you can download it and watch it. Jonathan gave a presentation to the school committee. I've watched it 3 times and still write questions from it. So there we go. Jonathan, what do you think? What did you derive from working with the Pittsfield people? What adaptations do you see?
I think, if you read the plan, it's really not as much about making sure AI is all over the place. It's it's about teaching kids the skills they will need to be able to use it. So that's an important distinction. I think what happens in most systems, and again, I'll go back to my systems orientation that we talked about before the break.
Yep.
If you create a curriculum and assessment structure that is primarily focused on what kids know versus what they can do, then you have a misalignment between what they need for their future and what we are doing to prepare them for it. You asked me about the jobs that'll be displaced.
Yeah.
Over the next 10 to 20 years, just about anything that does not require a uniquely human involvement, strong emotional attachments, strong communication, intuitive creativity, complex, very complex problem solving, just about all that work that's not that is vulnerable to AI. So certainly every mechanical procedure is at risk. Most low-level knowledge work is at risk. In the first 28 months that AI has been public-facing, 25% of all written words you encounter have been touched in some way by AI. 25% of all coding right now is being done by AI. So that's, I have a slide that I use in my more recent presentations. Yeah. It's like 28 equals 25. That number is just, both those numbers are going to rise. So just about all low-level, mid-level knowledge work, all routinized mechanical work, a fair amount of driving, you know, the list goes on and on. And that is what's going to happen. Now, in the long term, you know, I'm quite certain that AI is going to create jobs too.
Oh, yeah.
We just don't know what they are yet. And in the transition, there's going to be a lot of displacement. So that's going to be a challenge for us.
And again, be aware of it. Don't be afraid of it. And start to embrace it, I guess, is what I would say. It's not going away.
No, it's not.
Not going away.
No, and if you think it is, just ask yourself something. So, you know, we enjoy the benefits of living in a capitalist society.
Yes.
We pursue capital to better our own lives and to help improve the quality of not only our lives, but our descendants' lives. If you're in the job of acquiring capital, you are going to invest in things that give you the greatest potential return on that capital.
That's right.
So if I'm building something and I can employ 20 people, or I could build 20 robots, the robots are a one-time cost, slow, you know, less for maintenance. They work 24/7. They don't call in sick. They never complain. There's no office drama. They never file a grievance. They just keep doing what they're supposed to do. So you are going to invest in a digital worker over a human worker, because in the end, it will do what you need it to do, and that is help you make more money. So if you think that this is going away, you need to get yourself to a country that has no desire to acquire capital in the future. And that might be a grass hut in South America somewhere, but everywhere else, you're going to be in the danger zone.
And going back, that and such a, what he Jonathan just said is so important. And I guess we have to understand, while we, and I don't want to say we, while people may, I personally am in trying to embrace it at 78. And, you know, I'm a guy that had a cell phone for 2 months and didn't realize he had a camera in it. So there you go. So you don't want to hire me as one of your presenters. But and why I'm doing this and really believe in this program and believe in this guy and his company is because this is the future. And like it, don't like it, that's up to you. But you better embrace it because they'll be running circles around you. One of the guys on television said, "Video, what do they call it? Pre-record this program or download, whatever." He uses some. And if you don't know how to do it, get your 9-year-old to come in and show you.
That's right.
Right. When the strategic coherence planning process, that was I found that amazing. I've had to, through my career, I had to do a lot of planning and, you know, kind of like looking to the future, and you know, what I used to think the most ridiculous thing, a 5-year strategic plan. I used to say, why don't we do a 6-month strategic plan?
Right.
5 years. But this is really commitment to the principles of coherence planning. Just hit that for me, will you? Please.
Sure. So, you know, I've been doing strategic planning at the organizational level since 1990. And for the first 20 years of it, I used just the very common approach, which was go out, do your data scan, see what matters, set goals, and then plan around them. And what that turns into is sort of it's like everybody gets a treat. So in order to build support for our plan, we're going to take all the constituents that participate in it, and we'll get a goal or an objective that makes all of them happy. So in a school setting, you know, the band boosters are going to get a goal, the sports boosters are going to get a goal, the English department is going to get a goal, everybody's going to get a goal.
Yeah.
But the problem is districts are already running at their capacity. They don't have the ability to write a blank check. Everyone's going as hard as they possibly can. So where's all this new stuff going to come from, and how's everybody going to do it? And after 20 years of that and watching not a lot happen as a result of the plans, I sort of just had a crisis moment and said, you know, this isn't working. What can we do differently? The systems approach, right? If you ask the wrong question, you are going to get the wrong answer. So I tried to take the Pareto principle and a systems orientation to heart and created this process, which is essentially backwards design. So it starts with the end. The end is the vision of the graduate. Okay, so that's what we say is the most important thing we want every student in Pittsfield to do. And that was prior to my arrival. So you've already set out what it is that's the most important thing. So from there, the strategic coherence process is, all right, let's look at curriculum development, teaching methods, assessment methods, all the things that a district does on a day-to-day basis, and examine them for their alignment with the thing that you just said was the most important thing. And if what you're doing is aligned with it, well done. Keep doing it. Keep doing it. Let's learn from that. How could we do that thing in other areas? But in those areas where it is not aligned, then ask, why are you doing it if it's not aligned? You just said this is the most important thing.
Yeah.
So why are you doing something that is not aligned with your most important thing?
Yeah.
So the strategic coherence plan is just identifying the gaps in practice between what you said you wanted and what you do every day, and closing that gap and driving over time to make sure that what you do every day is leading you toward the thing you said was the most important thing, is this plan. So strategic coherence planning seeks to gain support by connecting action to what everyone in the community recognizes is the most important thing they need to do. That's the difference.
And this whole plan, and I kind of want to jump ahead just for time reasons. And
sure.
I could keep you here all day, but your boss could probably get angry. Define the gap, and I think this is really, you just kind of said it. I want to go beyond. Identify 2 to 5 priority gap closing strategic actions.
Yep.
I found that fascinating.
So that's the whole process. So in going through the data collection, what we identified as the 4 major strategic gaps were a lack of shared understanding of what that portrait actually says and means, the commitment to durable instruction, durable goals for learning, that was the AI vulnerable and durable, the connecting of teacher evaluation and professional learning. So we're going to invest on teaching you new things, and then we're going to come in and give you feedback on how well you're doing them. And then finally, making sure that the new folks we bring into the system are able and dedicated to working on those things to help kids be prepared for their future. So those were the 4 biggest gaps between current practice and implementation of the vision of the graduate, and that's why the plan looks the way it does.
And again, going out to the public, I better do this or I'll be in trouble. The views and opinions expressed on this program are mine and those of my guests. They in no way represent the Pittsfield School Department School Committee, the Mayor's Office, Peter Marchetti, the City Council, Peter White, and or anybody else who had anything else to say. But that's kind of a disclaimer.
I understand. And I just, you've been very complimentary, and I appreciate your kind words. But it's really important for all your listeners to understand that what those gaps are and the selection of them, all of that was done by the planning team.
Exactly. All I
did was say to them, here's a process you can use to identify what you need to do. They went out and collected the data. They did the analysis. They did the prioritization. I provided the structure. The employees, parents, and constituents of the Pittsfield Public Schools generated and selected the content.
And I can't stress that enough. If you watch, most of them were there. And there wasn't resistance. The team, from what I understand, the team worked as a team.
And, absolutely.
And that to me, I know Pittsfield gets slapped around a lot, but I think one of the things, I'm a product, that's probably not a good example, but I'm a product of the PHS, but we still had inkwells. But, and that's revolutionary. Think about it. Not that long ago, we had inkwells, and I used them. So there you go. Now we're talking about computers and all kinds of things. But if you watched Jonathan give his presentation, you would have known right he couldn't have been as factual and in-depth as he was without this team behind him. And I applaud all the teachers, all the principals, all the other folks that were on this team, and I'd read them all, but there's like probably 20 people, I would think. Right, Jonathan? Pretty close?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, my personal shout out is to Joe, because, you know, this isn't something that that just anybody takes on. And Joe had the wherewithal, the commitment, and the leadership to undertake it, to support it, and to take it across the finish line. So, you know, as I said a few minutes ago, you've been very complimentary of me, But I was just working for Joe and for the Pittsfield Public Schools to provide a process for them to get to a place that they wanted to get at. So all credit to Joe Curtis, his leadership team, and the folks that were on the planning team.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I'll tell you a quick story. I met Joe Curtis many years ago when he was a principal at Morningside. And I'm a big guy. What's your philosophy of life? Because to me, life is so precious. At a young age, I found out how quickly it could be snuffed out. And he said, I get up in the morning and I set a bar for myself. I set a bar for my kids. I set a bar for my teachers. I set a bar for my students. And the one, because of my youthful offender background, I set a bar for their parents.
Mm.
Because, you know, as a teacher, it's parents can influence kids and educate, whether it's AI or no AI. If it's a parental. But before we run out of time, I do want to say that thank you for that, because, again, working together as a team, I've been to a lot of, through my career, a lot of programs like yours. And I am going to compliment you, because I think I've sat through those kinds of strategic planning sessions to the point I was like, where's the gun?
I understand.
But you, the team was great, but you facilitated the team. And that's a credit to you, sir. And I
thank you. Thank you.
You've been to those where you're saying, I forgot more than this guy knows, you know, nobody was saying that in your group. What do you think some of the drawbacks in education will be with AI?
I think my biggest fear is what will happen to those that are left behind. So technologies like this have great potential to be equalizers. Right. If you can imagine a group of disaffected students being trained up on these tools, they could accelerate their progress and get to a place that helps them achieve faster. If they don't have access to that, and others with means around them do, the gap between those who can and those that can't will simply grow. And so if not managed carefully, I think AI has great potential to worsen the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And that is not a good place for our culture and society to be.
Excellent point. Can I share one with you? And you please correct me if you think I'm wrong.
Sure.
I've been married, 55 years, and my wife's on volume 47 of my wrongs. So they, my fear of it is it will de-socialize, depersonalize, dehumanize people.
I think it's a valid concern, right? I think, right now, more than dehumanize, I think it's also going to create, and it already has done this, by the way, people will develop emotional attachments to their AI friends. Because right now I can interact with a conversational chatbot and they will never be critical of me. They will always be supportive of me. They will compliment me and support me no matter what. How many people in your life do you know who will do that for you? Is it dehumanizing to treat something that acts like a human as a human? I don't know, but it will create these incentives, I think, for some, not to dehumanize things, but to live in a digital virtual world that doesn't really exist, except in ones and zeros in a server somewhere. And I don't know how to combat that unless we take it and say, the reason this is happening is because those people are not finding that kind of human connection in the real world. Let's pay more attention to that and not lose sight of what we're supposed to be.
That's an excellent explanation. And I think you're right. But I also think, too, that some people who are not good with pencil and paper, and I'm just using that.
Yeah,
is a metaphor kind of thing. Not good with pencil and paper, but can be super on these machines. They will excel.
Yeah, I don't have any question about that. You know,
yeah.
And there have always been loners for as long as there have been us, right?
Yeah.
In my time, that was the student who read science fiction books, read comic books, sat in the corner, didn't talk to anyone. These technologies tend to intensify that. So it's easier to be isolated. It's easier to shut people off who you don't agree with and you don't have to interact with them anymore. I mean, that trend started before AI, and I think will intensify it. And that even puts a greater burden on us to be sure that these tools are used appropriately and under adult supervision. You know, people who want to ban this stuff in schools, and I completely agree that unfettered use of this among youngsters, among young teens, especially as it relates to social media, can be very detrimental. But to say the answer to that is get them out, everybody out of the pool, that's a sledgehammer to solve a problem that requires a scalpel. Yes, don't use social media until you're 16, but we are going to have to interact with AI, whether it's through a phone or a laptop or something, long before that, because if you spend your whole academic career in an analog environment and then have to sink or swim in a digital world, many will not swim.
Right. Jonathan, you have been an inspiration to an old guy to learn how to use a cell phone more. I mean, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for the nice things and the true things you said about the Pittsfield school system. I hope we can stay connected through the years. I don't think you got to worry about me much longer, but seriously, thank you for this. And if I can do anything to ever promote you, please.
Thank you so much.
I'll send you a link of this show.
Great. I appreciate it. And very much appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Be well and have a wonderful summer when it comes. We woke up to a new coating of snow.
We did as well.
Oh, God. Thanks, Jonathan. Be well.
Take care. Bye-bye.